Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Catherine Eaton Skinner, a multidisciplinary artist incorporating painting, encaustic, sculpture, printmaking, and photography. Catherine grew up east of Seattle and attended Stanford University in San Francisco, where she completed her BA in biology and studied art with renowned artists Nathan Oliveira and Frank Blondeau. She began her art career as a biological illustrator, specializing in the ecological integration of marine invertebrates and algae of the Pacific coast. Catherine has also traveled extensively over the years, exploring many cultures and innovatively given expression to her expedition discoveries in her artwork. Catherine's art has been juried in national and international shows, exhibited in many solo and group exhibitions in museum, university, gallery, and embassy settings, such as the Tokyo American Embassy for the Art and Embassies Program. Her work is represented by galleries such as Gallery Fritz in Santa Fe, New Mexico, Abmeyer and Wood Fine Art in Seattle, and Seeger Gray Gallery in California. Catherine's work may be found in numerous private, public, and corporate collections such as Tacoma Art Museum, Boeing Corporation, and more. She has written and contributed to a number of publications, including Speak for the Trees, Unleashed, and the recently released monograph 108. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be talking to you, and after listening to that introduction, maybe we don't need to do any of the questions.
Okay. Well, let's start with the first one, and your innovative multimedia works come to life with a focus on unique concepts embracing numerical systems, patterning, exotic traditions, and more. Would you like to tell us about your background and what has been influential in your artistic development?
Well, I started at Stanford, as you said, and was taking biology and decided I needed to take art classes to survive the rigmarole of trying to get through biology at Stanford. So I started with Frank Lobdell in drawing and then Nathan Oliveira and in painting. And I worked with them for a couple of years, but then I went down to Hopkins Marine Station on the coast and started doing illustration for a project that was actually, we were publishing at the time. And so I was going to be a medical illustrator, and when I started in marine work, it just clicked with me more than the medical illustration. And I went to Stanford in Italy, so they spent 6 months in Florence, and we had art classes and traveled. And then I never went back and got a master's because I got married right out of college and started having children. So I did weekend workshops whenever I could because I was living on San Juan Island on an island, so it wasn't easy to get off. So I basically then later started doing longer retreats and workshops, and I did two in Santa Fe Art Institute with Ann Truitt and met up again with Nathan Oliveira, my professor, and I've been twice to Pilchuck, which is in the Northwest Glass Retreat Studios, and then my last one was in Venice doing East-West calligraphy. So we studied Eastern calligraphy, and then we studied Western calligraphy, and then we sort of went anything goes. I've always worked since I was 19. I think I started as a professional artist and never really stopped.
You grew up surrounded by powerful natural landscapes, fresh and salt waters, majestic mountains, and dense forests, and you've traveled to many other countries. How might these natural landscapes and different cultures have inspired connections in your art practice?
Well, I've always lived close to the land, and I grew up surrounded by trees, and my parents gardened, and then I farmed and had animals when the kids were growing up. And so with illustration, one of the things you do is you have to learn to observe and see, and your line has to be what is actually there. You can't vary from it. And so I learned early in order to draw and see and put down what I was seeing in three dimensions. And then when I started traveling, my early travels were more conventional to Europe and so on. But in 1997, I went to Indonesia. And then really what changed things, I went to Bhutan in 2003, and which is a very Buddhist country. I've been back twice. And they live and work within their Buddhist tradition. And so I became really interested in how people are connected to the spaces around them and how things become sacred to them within those spaces, using all the elements, earth, water, fire, air, wind, and ether. And since I'd already been sort of working in those elements as a natural scientific illustrator, it was, how do I take that into my art in a different way? So after Bhutan, I just started using the number 108. I'd had some things going on in my family and around me that were difficult, so I came back to the studio from that travel, and I tore up 108 pieces of paper and started making circles on them. And that was the beginning of using that number, which I've used continually since then.
In highlighting that number 108 in many of your works, particularly in something like Gayak G, can you tell us about this series and how you've brought powerful meanings from this number 108 into your works?
Well, 108 is a number that's connected to a lot of natural numerical systems and spiritual practice, especially in the East. They use it in Hinduism, they use it in Buddhism, and so on. And it's used as a repetition for mantras. It's used as repetition in designs. And so when I came back, I started making mainly circles. And I used the name Manaratna in the beginning, which is the number of beads on the Buddhist mala. When people say prayers, it's a Buddhist rosary. And there's 108 beads. And then enzos, which is Japanese, circles, and mandalas, and so on. And then I started using it as a way of counting within all my series. So I did series, was always working with ravens, and so I did 108 ravens. I was working with stones, and I would do things with 108 stones. And finally, the last series I really worked on was taking 108 as a code and switching it to binary codes and QR codes and all the modern-day codes, tally marks, and so on, but using that age-old cosmic number, but bringing it forward with different codes.
In addition to those types of concepts, how has your mastery of materials and your process evolved over your career, and can you describe some of your works for our audience?
In the late 30s, when I really started going back to painting again, what I did, because I've been using so much black, and for my illustration, I decided to not allow myself to use black. The first sort of abstract series, like Shadow Mark and Side Truss, I ended up doing a lot of drawing and then cropping, so the elemental series I was drawing became abstracted into certain shapes. And then I just did oil and a lot of color and texture. I think I was influenced a bit by the San Francisco painters at the time, because immediately I was going back to the days at Stanford when I was painting. So it wasn't too difficult to go back, because I hadn't really worked in oils for a long time. And then going all the way forward, so the last series I just finished is called Azimuth. It's part of the accumulation series. So when I finished the 108 book, what I did is allow myself to do repetition without counting. Counting the lines, counting the circles. And so it's called accumulations, and Azimuth is 108 boards, but it's a mixed process of oil stick and Himalayan papers, all done in a monotype process, and then put down on board with wax. So it combines a lot of the different methods that I use together, which I've always allowed myself to do and experiment with.
You've also participated in several solo and group exhibitions, and your works are in many prestigious collections. Can you share some of your most compelling experiences from these opportunities?
Well, I've been in over 30 solo shows since I was, I think the first one I was in my late 30s. And early on, I was actually in a co-op gallery up on San Juan Island, which was great fun. We had to work and so on. But I think the most important thing since I started working on 108 is creating a sacred space within the gallery. And I usually decide on a concept. Sometimes I write poetry on it. I keep a lot of notebooks and words and drawings and so on. So I go through all of that, and then I allow myself usually lots of time to bring all the multiple facets of my work together around that one concept. And so the names of my shows are important. And people often say when they come into a show, oh my God, it's like being in a sacred space, whether it's abstract or not abstract. And I did do a show in Tokyo in 2012, and I was given two small rooms, and so that was really a great experience to have to ship everything over there and work with them, but it was really fun and very successful. So
you've also been fortunate to be in the family of artists that Artwork International Incorporated represents. What has your experience been with this invaluable organization?
Well, I met Samantha, who runs the organization, hers, a year ago, and it was a very serendipity meeting at another show, and it was a perfect match. I'd been approached before, and I really didn't want an agent. What she does is you sit down and figure out what you need to do, and just yourself. It's not what anyone else is doing, and I have a wonderful assistant here that I've worked with for 8 years. The three of us actually figured out, and we still are going go back and forth, but we want to have, in the studio, we want to have control as to what goes out and what comes in. And so it's really been a perfect match with them.
And not only do you have a remarkable artistic practice, but you also creatively write poetry, and you've written numerous books about the richness of traditions and history that you connect with elements of art in your works. Can you elaborate on a few of your publications, and what has this process been like?
Well, the first real book I did was Unleashed. And I had done a whole show of animal alphabet, but I did it through the animal eyes, and most of the works that I did were life-size animal eyes without necessarily the body of the animal. And as I was doing that, I'm like, this would make a really great book. So I started working with David Chicky, who is in Santa Fe and has Radius Books. This was not done within that nonprofit, but I worked with University of Washington Press, and then the Woodland Park Zoo was part of that, and we printed, I think we printed in Singapore 3,000 copies, oh my God, so now I use it as my calling card. Then 108, I started, it took 3 years, and I was accepted to do a book with Radius Books and David Chicky again. I knew Elizabeth Brown very well, who had been curator at the Henry Art Gallery at the University of Washington, and so it has over 120 images and 12 chapters, and so it was quite an organizational accomplishment to lay out that much artwork and make it make sense. But Elizabeth helped, Brown helped in her writing of each chapter, and then I found Newcomb Greenleaf, who wrote a very long poem. He's a Buddhist mathematician, and he wrote a wonderful long poem on what the meaning of 108 is in mathematics as related to Buddhism.
And do you have any upcoming exhibitions and books that you're excited about and would like to share with our audience?
Well, I'd love to do another book with Radius, and I don't have anything in the works except I keep thinking I would like to do more poetry, so that means I have to write more. I do most of my writing in Santa Fe, and I have a show with Waterworks Gallery in up on the island where I was. It's my 11th solo show, and that's called Illuminations. But that's mainly ravens and animals, because the island does not do well if I do the real abstract work. And then we have Azimuth on the walls in the studio, and it takes up 4 8-foot walls. So I really would love to do a museum show. I know it takes a long time and takes a while to get it set up, but that's what we're working for. And then I'm going to Peru in a week.
Nice.
And then back to India at the end of the year. So I do a lot of photography on my trips, and I do travel books, and they feed into whatever I'm working on or going to work on in the future.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for being on our show and sharing your story and insight with our audience, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Thank you.
All right.
That was Catherine Eaton Skinner, multidisciplinary artist, speaking with us from her studio in Seattle. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest, Vera Bosek, was born in Buffalo, New York, and grew up with her parents of Eastern European heritage in the sprawling suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio, where she explored the densely populated Rocky River watershed and surrounding landscapes with a fascination for natural elements. Vera completed her BFA in sculpture at Louisiana State University and began her practice with a focus on classical realism. She was then accepted into the apprenticeship program at the Johnson Atelier Technical Institute of Sculpture and had her work juried in the annual exhibition at the National Academy of Design and the non-members exhibition at the Salmagundi Club in Manhattan. Moving to Key West, Florida, she discovered the backcountry and zone of the Keys, and here she began her innovative process, such as pulling plaster images off the tidal markings found in the sand produced by the flow of water, documenting movements of the natural elements. Vera has exhibited her work widely in its installations at the Fort Zachary Taylor Historic Park and Key West Garden Club in Florida, to name a few. She has been the executive director of the Sculpture Key West International event in Florida and has been highlighted in Sculpture Magazine's Gallery of Works in their 2014 edition. Good evening and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've produced an entrancing video that details your working process and how you captured the natural elements of the backcountry of the Florida Keys in your sculpture, Tidal Relief. Can you describe the unique, innovative process behind this remarkable sculpture?
Oh, thank you. Well, it all kind of is process-oriented. I began just pulling plaster forms off of sand when I first got to the Keys, and I found that pulling larger pieces kind of replicated my experience in the awesome backcountry, where you're totally surrounded by the water and the horizon and the colors and nature in general, I guess. So I thought that I really should document my time doing this. As years went on, I thought, well, why don't I just go ahead and do this? And so that was filmed in 2007, but there were other films before that. I had a friend who at the time had a company and he did advertising, filming and all of that. So he kind of worked filming me while I was producing. And I thought, well, you know, let me just make my own film the way I want it to be seen, because really only I'm the one that knew what my experience was all about and why I was doing it. And so that is the film that you're talking about.
And can you tell us a bit about that process and how you discovered this technique and what was in that film? Because it was really interesting as far as showing the process.
Well, thank you. Well, I first started the entire process when I left New York City. I was up there for a few years, and I wanted to totally clear my head because at the time I was doing classical realism, and I really enjoyed it, but then it just was not doing anything for me. I needed to find something else, and I didn't quite know what it was, so I decided to leave New York for a while. I found my way to Key West, where my sister told me I had to check it out, and I really didn't even know where it was. So by the time I got there, I found the backcountry, and I realized that, well, I could be a struggling artist there as I was up in New York, bartending and trying to find my way. So I decided to just really look and search, and I found myself in an isolated sandbar, and I realized I can just start there. I wanted to start from the beginning. I didn't know where that was. I wanted to totally erase everything that I picked up over the years, and I wanted to start over. And I didn't know if that was possible. So when I saw the tidal flow and I saw how the actual tides were just influencing the sand and the material and particulates of sand on the low-lying areas, I thought, well, let me give this a try. So I started using techniques that I picked up over the years, mold making and things, and I picked up my materials, the plaster, the burlap, the conduit, and I started making molds on the found sand formations. And of course, that all had to be timed correctly. I had about 2 hours from low tide to high tide. So I learned a lot through that process. Being from the city, I wasn't really in tune to some of the natural kind of things that happen around there. So I picked up that, okay, you know, I have a couple hours, so let me do what I can do. And I found that I could get as large as something like 5 feet by 6 feet in producing these large plaster reliefs, which I now call tidal reliefs. And so the tidal reliefs themselves have evolved, and they're no longer windows in the world, as I was kind of thinking of it, that windows in something that was unknown to me. They've evolved from just a basic mold to the actual work, to being actual part of the work.
Were any of your ideas informed by earlier or current landscape artists?
Oh, there's so much. Yes, definitely. I picked up so much over the years. And of course, I think with Robert Smithson, with his earthworks, his spiral jetty, of course, that comes to mind, that was really left an impression. And of course, his non-sites and his site. And I loved his mirrored works. That kind of started the conversation. But that wasn't the end, because I was just not really into the destruction of things. I was into the beginning of things. And I think that using Robert Smithson as an example you have the other earthwork artists like Michael Hauser and all of that. And also, was it Oppenheimer? I forget. But it's just taking the elements of the outside and bringing them inside. To me, that was just really phenomenal. I thought, okay, I can do that. And also, things start evolving as well, because with the images I was taking off the sand, of course, the sand is a positive, the plaster is a negative. Mm-hmm. So you're having various other techniques. The process starts to bring you into other things. And that's what it started to do for me. And I found that I actually was a process artist. I was open to letting things kind of happen and experiment. And I found also eventually that it wasn't just what was found in the sand. It was what was influencing that. I mean, what is going on here? And also just from the various colors that I would be in contact with and experience and perceive, with the light influencing so many things in the backcountry, that started influencing a lot of my work going forward.
How does your approach change as you do a variety of your installations and sculptures when you work with different materials and other landscapes?
Well, I guess it depends on, maybe it's like in situ, if right. there is an installation going on somewhere that's in an historic structure. I found that being involved with Sculpture Key West was really great, because there's three red brick structures in Key West itself. And with those, they're just great opportunities for producing various elements, artistic, creative elements within these structures, historically and otherwise, visually just astounding. So I started producing that. I guess I was getting into a kind of like a magical realism kind of thing, where, yes, I was getting away from the body, but my body was actually part of the piece. You know, when you think about the title reliefs that I was producing. But and with the installations, I would carry the title reliefs into these installations, kind of like what Jasper Johns, he would kind of do things and do something else. And that's kind of, again, something I've picked up over the years. Just, I can't help but being influenced by artists who have made it and, you know, are in the media.
Well, it's interesting that you've taken it from the ephemeral, such as Andy Goldsworthy in the UK, and you've been able to capture it into a sculpture and bring it to your audience that way. What do you hope to bring to your viewers' experience with your work?
Well, there's so much. There is so much out there. And I just think the experience of the unknown, and to keep on asking questions. We're in this digital age where so much is happening, and we're not really in tune with the outdoors as much. At least I still need a lot. I need to spend more time outdoors. I would like to connect, and I would like to learn from it somehow, some way. And I find that a lot of it is bringing me toward a like scientific kind of inquiry, where I just love the latest, with the space dragon that actually made it just recently. There's a lot of astrophysics, a lot of things going on that is just amazing, that brings part of the world back down to us. So again, there's just so much going on there that it just kind of opens my world up more. And I just hope that for people, for artists who are just starting out, just to keep your mind open and go with your gut feeling.
You've also been involved in the Sculpture Key West initiative. Can you tell us about this organization, how it began, and how it contributes to the artistic community and recognition for many artists?
Well, it began early on, artists by artists, and then it evolved into an actual nonprofit. And it evolved from local artists in Key West to bringing together artists from all over, from the United States and also Europe, Australia. It was exciting at the time, but it no longer exists. It had its time. The funding was always difficult to find. I have faith. I think sooner or later it's going to be revived again. I think the last exhibition was in 2013, so it's already 2019. There's a lot going on in Key West, per se, so I still hold out for that, definitely.
What about the Sugarloaf projects, and what kind of works have you designed for that?
Yeah, see, that's something, because I live in this really bizarre area of the Keys where I have to conform, I have to live my life according to the tidal movements. I'm in a spit of land that's off the major road, and sometimes, various times of the year, the water rises, so I have to keep my truck parked on the main boulevard, and I have to walk a quarter mile up to my house, knee-high boots. And doing that, which I really didn't expect that I would be at this point when I started doing my tidal reliefs, you know, way back in the 1990s. So now we're here at 2019, And I realized, okay, I'm at this point, and now this is much more than just what I find on a sandbar. There's a lot going on environmentally. We're dealing in an age right now where we're looking at global warming effects. Who knows how drastic they'll be over the next 10, 20 years. But I feel like I'm kind of in a position to work with that. So it's just another material for me to work with in this property that I have, with the tides going up and down around me in the tidal flats, and with the various plants that find themselves seeded here just from the winds or the birds or whatever. I have this kind of like little mini forest going on of indigenous and invasives. I'm going to manipulate that in a way where it will be another kind of part of my work. And again, it's something where I'm just kind of going forward, not knowing exactly what I'm doing, but I will be using everything I've picked up over the past years and working with this new area. So instead of working with historic landmarks in Key West, I'll be working with this outdoor area. And again, my work has been evolving from the tidal reliefs. Again, they were kind of like something for me to look into, to kind of learn from, and they've been evolving through the installations and through other things that have influenced me. And I'm back into drawing with this type of movement. I've created some movement drawings from my tidal reliefs, and now I'm creating sculptural forms out of the movement drawings, all kind of like becoming something new, something like I'm working with new entities. So it's just kind of crazy stuff, but I'm really enjoying it.
And where do you plan on exhibiting those? Have you got something particular coming up?
Well, I'm involved in an organization called American Abstract Artists. That happened, my involvement in this, I was brought into that organization back in 2006, and a woman artist who I came to know in Key West. She saw my work, and we got to talking, and we got to know each other. And I mentioned to her one time at a gathering, I said, you know, it's really difficult. I would love to get my work out there, but it's just, you know, it's kind of just here in the Keys. And she thought, oh, I have an idea. So she presented me in one of their yearly intakes, is what they want to call it, for membership. I was brought in. And since 2006, I've been in some really incredible exhibitions, and I'm really involved with a lot of incredible artists. And I love that the focus is abstraction, of course. This organization began in 1936, and it's continuing on with this whole focus of immediacy and light and purity. And so it really all fit into with my work. A lot has been going on. Trying to post my resume online. There's a lot of other things I want to do. So maybe eventually you'll see what I've been involved in. But up currently, just this past year, there's two exhibitions that are really interesting to me and I'm very happy to be part of. One is called Blurring Boundaries. It was put together by the University of Tennessee, and it is the Women of American Abstract Artists from 1936 to the present. And the team that put that together, Sam Yates is the director and curator of this, and his assistant, Sarah Falls, they've been fantastic in pulling this all together, and it'll be traveling in the next few years. You'll be able to see it, I believe, it's on a website, International Art and Artists. It's artsandartists.org. You'll see that it's listed there, and beginning in 2020 or so, it's going to start exhibiting, or 2022, something like that.
Does it travel to Canada at all?
You know, it could. I mean, because this is through the International Art and Artists. I know they even exhibit in Europe. So it would be really great to get that in Canada.
Yeah,
it would. Definitely.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your innovative works and advice with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you continued success in your upcoming exhibitions.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.